Good morning. We once again have an edition of the Doctor's Lounge. I'm your host for this morning, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm going to dispense with the usual formalities in starting the show and get right to our very special guest, Mr. John Graham. He is a senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis, which, like Docs for Patient Care Foundation, is a 501c3 nonprofit. They are a nonpartisan public policy research organization established in 1983, and they write lots of really good stuff about healthcare, and John kind of leads that charge. I could go on about his CV all through the first segment here, but what impresses me is that in addition to sort of having a think tank experience, he has military experience, he has financial experience, and all in all, is just one of these really, really smart guys who writes really, really good stuff. So, John, good morning, and thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me back on your show.
Sure. Today's discussion is going to be about an article that you just put out to yesterday on the NCPA website, which is, of course, very timely and very relevant as we approach, perhaps within a few hours, a ruling from the Supreme Court on King versus Burwell, which is, of course, the whole question about Obamacare subsidies and whether states which are using healthcare.gov rather than a state exchange are actually eligible under the law to have those subsidies. So go ahead and give us a little bit of background, and then we'll kind of go right into the article.
Well, we've been on tenterhooks for quite some time here about this lawsuit called King v. Burwell. And just to make sure your audience understands the background, it's very important for doctors and patients to understand that this case can have big repercussions for Obamacare and is going to put a lot of responsibility on both the President and the Congress and the governors and the state legislatures to respond if the Supreme Court finds in favor of the plaintiff, Mr. King. And the assertion in the lawsuit, which is obviously a credible and powerful assertion, or it wouldn't have gotten to the Supreme Court if it was just silliness, is that in at least 34 and maybe 37 states, the Obamacare tax credits that are currently being paid to health insurers through these exchanges are illegal. That the black letter of the law, the Affordable Care Act, which was signed in 2010, says that these tax credits, which this year will be about $20 billion and in the next couple of years we'll run up to about $50 billion a year, can only be paid if a state itself has set up an exchange. Well, only 16 states set up their own exchanges, and Georgia wasn't one of them.
The majority of states didn't
set up these exchanges. So the federal government set up healthcare.gov, and people remember from 2014 that was a fiasco.
Yes.
And this year it worked a little better in terms of people signing up for the exchanges at healthcare.gov, but they shouldn't be getting tax credits through these exchanges. And the administration has been paying tax credits through these exchanges for 2 years now. And most people in Obamacare, we've got about 10 million people in Obamacare, and in round numbers, 6+ million of them are in these states, 34 to 37 states, which are using healthcare.gov and don't have their state exchange. So this morning or tomorrow morning or Monday morning,
yes,
it will be decided by the Supreme Court, and 6+ million people could lose these tax credits. Now, what does that mean? That means their premiums in the majority of states will go up by $3,000+. And these folks are going to have shell shock. They've been getting artificially low premiums for their health insurance they're getting through the Obamacare exchange. And all of a sudden, many of them will decide, well, if I have to pay the full premium, I don't think I'm going to pay. And this is going to provoke a huge crisis, as you can imagine. If most of the people in Obamacare exchanges don't get their tax credits, don't get their subsidies, they're suddenly going to be faced with the reality of the cost of Obamacare.
Yeah, what
and,
insurance really costs.
It's going to provoke a crisis that the president's going to have to respond to, Congress is going to have to respond to it, and the governors and legislatures in these states like Georgia are going to be faced with a lot of pressure from the hospitals, from the health insurers, from all the people in the medical government complex to say, hey, we got to turn those subsidies back on. What are you going to do about it? And so it creates an opportunity for folks like us who say that Obamacare was a bad law And, you know, it gives us the opportunity to say, well, okay, let's revisit it and let's see what we can do. We can't repeal and replace it. The president won't tolerate that. But are there some changes that we can make to this law that will get us through the political crisis and hopefully get us on a glide path to a better health reform a few years down the road?
Well, I was very intrigued, and you're leading right into it, of course, which is sort of your overall philosophy in the article and the overall approach, which is, you know, very important, I think, for the physicians in the audience to get their arms around, which is the idea that, you know, a complete repeal, you know, a two-page bill that says everything that was in the 2000 ACA is null and void. Yeah. Would be emotionally satisfying, but doesn't really work. So tell everybody about sort of the overall sort of approach before we actually get to the particulars of your proposal.
Yeah, so I'm not very good at political tactics, but we sort of have to be in this environment. There's going to be if the Supreme Court decides today or tomorrow or Monday, and the reason I say today, tomorrow, or Monday is that's the end of the Supreme Court term, and they all fly off to the beaches, and they reconvene in the autumn. So any case that was argued in the spring has to be decided by next Monday at the latest. And the King v. Burwell is a big one. There's also a gay marriage case that's a big one. So those are the two big ones that people are looking for, and they have to be decided by next Monday. So the problem with it, as I see it, is that the president has an easy solution, and he's already said it. He said, okay, if the Supreme Court gets it wrong, if the Supreme Court says that the black letter of the law is these tax credits can only be paid through state-based exchanges and not healthcare.gov, well, I've got a one-sentence amendment to the law that says they can also be paid through healthcare.gov, and that's the way we've been doing it for 2 years now. So here's my one sentence, and here's my cancer patient who's going to lose her access to oncology if she loses her tax credit through the Obamacare plan, and here's the Alzheimer's patient and all that stuff.
Sure.
And he stands there, and as days go by, he wins the public debate because he's got this easy solution, and the ordinary person is going to say, well, obviously that's the solution because that's the way the law was being executed until the Supreme Court overturned it, so let's just do that. Another response is more complicated, more complex, harder to communicate to people. And when I look at what Congress has done so far in anticipation of the King v. Burwell ruling, I don't think they're really ready to go. I don't think they have a response ready to go. The statements I've heard from Mr. Ryan and Mr. Boehner and Senator McConnell, and I don't think they really know how to respond quickly to this. And my concern is that it looks like they might just extend the Obamacare tax credits for maybe 2 years and say, well, we'll revisit it in 2017. Well, of course, we call that kicking the can down the road.
Sure.
The doctors, remember the doc fix, right?
Right, that's exactly what I was going to say.
The doc fix can down the road for about 10-plus years, right?
It's SGR all over again, yes.
Exactly. And, you know, I hate to say it, but when I look at the Republicans in Congress, you know, are they ready with health reform? And, there's a lot of good ideas out there, but they don't have a plan that they have coalesced around. And
right.
If you don't have a plan you've coalesced around, you don't have a stepwise approach to that plan either. If you don't know what your goal is, you can't say, well, here's a step that'll get me one quarter way to my goal, or, you know, at least one or two steps to my goal. You just sort of say, I'll kick the can down the road. And the Obamacare tax credit problem is, I think the most likely thing that they might do, if they don't pay attention to what I've proposed, is just re-up the Obamacare tax credits in the federal exchange to, say, August 2017. That's what Senator Johnson proposed. Well, there you've got two problems. One is that, okay, the Supreme Court says the law never authorized this spending. So the Congressional Budget Office, again, doctors probably don't care what the Congressional Budget Office says, but Congress does. The
Sure.
Congressional Budget Office says, oh, so actually the cost of Obamacare is about two-thirds less than what we thought because the law as written, the Supreme Court just told us, didn't authorize this money. So, you know, if you just re-up the money and start paying it again, you have a real problem in that you're spending more money than the original law authorized, and you are sort of endorsing these illegal payments that the president was making. And then you make this assumption that by August 2017, oh, well, we'll have a Republican president, and we will have our alternative health reform, our patient-centered health reform, will have been signed in the spring of 2017, and we'll be happily going along with our consumer-directed, patient-centered health reform, and therefore the Obamacare tax credits will just expire in August 2017. And, well, you know, I don't think that's going to happen. It might happen. I hope it does. But my observation of congressional Republicans is that by, you know, August 2017, even if they have a great president who wants patient-centered health reform, if we are betting that that will happen, you know, it's hope over experience.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll come into August 2017, and it'll be like the sustainable growth rate SGR doc fix. They'll say, oh, gosh, we haven't solved the problem yet. Let's kick it down the road another year.
Well,
and
exactly.
So I think, you know, my overarching theme in this article I've written is let's not do that. Let's not kick the can down the road and then pretend that when it hits us in the summer of 2017, we will have figured out, you know, what to do. Let's do something that is real, substantive, does something to fix this problem. Maybe not much. You know, the president's got to sign it. I'm also not a fan of this idea that we'll pass another bill, maybe through reconciliation, that the president vetoes. I don't see what good that does, because the president then still keeps standing there with his one-sentence bill saying, look, you've got 6 or 7 million people who have lost their access to health insurance, and here's my solution. It takes, you know, it's 12 words, and, you know, eventually they'll cave into that, or the governors will cave in and start setting up these state-based exchanges. And because that's the other way to get the tax credits flowing. If Congress and the president go into a standoff, the governor of a state can turn on a state-based exchange, which is hugely problematic. I mean, in my paper I describe what's happened in these state-based exchanges. Hawaii just shut their exchange down. You know, the state-based exchanges are collapsing. The only one, the big ones, are New York and California. They're having a lot of problems. The California exchange bureaucrats have just voted themselves a raise, and yet the exchange is operating like a rickety old Model T on an interstate. The only state-based exchange that one could say in an operational sense is really operating smoothly is Connecticut. But, you know, you can't, that's the exception that proves the rule that these things are failures. And the state-based exchanges were still operating until now on federal government grants. And those grants are running out. So states that have exchanges, these minority of states that have exchanges, are now having contentious debates in their state legislatures. How are we going to get the millions of dollars it costs to operate the exchanges, to continue the contracts with the information technology vendors and things like that? So for a state of a governor like the governor of a state like Georgia, for example, to say, okay, now we're going to turn on a state exchange, well, now he's back in a kind of a 2013-2014 scenario where he's got to deal with IT contracts, he's got to deal with erecting a new bureaucracy, a new Department of Motor Vehicles for healthcare, going to the legislature saying we need to get 50 or $100 million this year to set the darn thing up and then keep operating it. I mean, that's just going to be a painful experience that we don't want to see states like Georgia or any other state that doesn't have an exchange start doing in order to get this money flowing. So just kind of not putting something to the president, Congress not putting something to the president that he can swallow, I think is a loss. And I would hate to see Congress just allow that to happen without getting any fundamental reforms to Obamacare.
Awesome. That's a great introduction. It's time for a break.
All right.
We'll be back in a couple of minutes. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay with us.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your health care freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
My name is Dr. Jeff Terry from Mobile, Alabama. I love taking care of my patients and not computers. That is why I need your help. On October 1st, the government will mandate that I implement the new ICD-10 coding system, and if not able to do so, then I will be put out of business and my patients will have to find a new physician. Please call and write your congressmen and senators today and tell them no to ICD-10. Tell them physicians need a grace period in order to concentrate on you, the patient, and not the computer.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship.
I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, co-host of The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Please join us in the fight to save the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper and go to this website, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org.
You're listening to americaswebradio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. We have with us today a very special guest, John Graham, leading writer and thinker at the National Center for Policy Analysis. He brings not only healthcare think tank experience, but military experience and financial experience. And we're talking about the upcoming King versus Burwell decision. John, I think we were sort of transitioning from sort of introductory strategy into maybe the meat of your proposal, but I leave that up to you where you'd like to go.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for having me on your show. And I've made a number of proposals in my paper. Let me focus on the ones that I think the doctors would be most interested in.
Okay.
Obamacare has some problems that are more general, like there are general economic problems caused to our society by Obamacare. But, of course, it's also harmful to the practice of physicians. And one of the things that Obamacare does, it's no surprise to anybody by now, is that it dramatically increases the power of health insurers over everybody,
yeah.
over patients, over doctors. And the knock-on effects in the health insurance industry, we're now starting to see a consolidation, right? And you see
yes.
in the stock market, there's a frenzy of the big health insurers are going to merge. So that's going to be much more painful. You're going to have an effective duopoly of the large insurers. And this is all caused by Obamacare. And the problem, one of the problems with Obamacare is we talk about these tax credits. All the tax credits are paid to insurers. They're not paid to patients. So the artificial discount of the premium in the Obamacare exchange is done between the insurer and the government, the Treasury Department. The patient is not really involved.
Sure.
And there's another big cash flow in Obamacare called the cost-sharing subsidy. So people who are of low income, they not only get their premium subsidized, but they get their cost-sharing. You know, their copay and deductible are subsidized. But again, that goes to the insurance company, and that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So it's between the Treasury Department and the Aetna or Cigna or Blue Cross or Blue Shield or
sure.
Anthem or United Health Group will get this payment from the government that will reduce the cost sharing of the patient. Well, that doesn't help us in terms of getting to a patient-directed, consumer-directed system because the patient is not switched on about the cost that he's actually incurring. So one of my recommendations here is to, if we can't lower the dollar figure, I mean, remember, we got to get the president to sign this bill, whatever bill Congress proposes. So whatever the dollar figure is, even if they can't lower the taxpayers' liability in Obamacare significantly, at least let's get that money and not pay it directly to the health insurer. Let's pay it to the patient and let the patient decide how much he wants to spend on premium for a catastrophic health plan and how much he would like to spend directly on the medical services that he gets from the doctor and the other health care providers. Now, there may be some technical solutions have to be had here. Most of these people don't have health savings accounts, right? They're relatively low-income people. So we may have to have a technical tweak that they can set up a health savings account. But that'll be fine. I think that'll really move us a small but significant step towards a patient-driven system because right now, even left-wing groups that support Obamacare, Families USA, the Commonwealth Fund, have done research on the Obamacare beneficiaries. And their deductibles and copays are so high that they're avoiding care, and they're still having trouble paying for care. So why are we giving all the money to the insurance company? Let's give some of that money, at least some of that money, maybe not all of it. I can't predict what the president will accede to. But let's give some of that money to the patient so they can pay their deductibles and their co-pays. I think that would be a step in the right direction.
Exactly. And to me, it's almost analogous to your paycheck. If you're on a payroll where all you do is look at the money that you're putting in the bank, you don't look at how much you started with. And so you never really have a handle unless you go out of your way to look exactly how much is getting taken out in taxes. This is kind of the same thing on the expenditure side, right? I mean, all you see is what it costs you, and you don't see what's going on, you know, on the back end of this system.
Exactly. And one of the things that, you know, I'm a strong opponent of Obamacare, but I'm also a strong proponent that the individual should make his own choice about what his health insurance plan should be. And he shouldn't have to, as we did before Obamacare, get it from his employer. And more of that money should be under the patient's direct control and not controlled by the health insurer. And so that's something. You know, the reform I've just proposed is kind of a move in that direction. So it may be small, but it is significant, and it will be a permanent reform to Obamacare. So the next president in 2017 could say, okay, there was a positive reform to the Obamacare plan, so let's take the next step from there.
So
another thing is that what Republicans have kind of ignored, there's a couple of things that I think could be used in the court of public opinion to induce the president to sign a bill. And again, as I said in the first segment, I'm kind of disappointed that Mr. Ryan and Senator McConnell have said, well, the president will veto anything we propose. Well, that's not a very useful thing to say publicly before the opportunity has even arisen. So there are some things that people have kind of forgotten about in the last few years for various reasons. Well, one is, of course, the Independent Payment Advisory Panel, IPAB.
Yes.
Independent Payment Advisory Board, which was a big thing in 2010 when Obamacare was passed. People were freaking out, rightly so, that the president would have the opportunity to appoint 15 members of this Independent Payment Advisory Board, and these 15 people would vote and decide how to cut Medicare spending. And you know, all the 800,000 doctors in the country and the millions of patients on Medicare would have no say in this. These 15 czars would say, you know, Medicare's not going to cover this, Medicare's not going to cover that. Congress surrendered any influence in that process, and people were deriding this as death panels. And Republicans kept saying, well, we're going to repeal the IPAB. We're going to repeal the IPAB. And the IPAB became so politically toxic that it was supposed to already be standing up and running. And the president never nominated one of these 15 IPAB members, and because they had to be confirmed by the Senate. And even the president realized, once the law had been passed, that to start nominating death panel members and send them to the Senate, you know, that would be a catastrophe politically for him. So the IPAB is de facto non-existent. But let's get it non-existent in the law. I think Republicans in Congress would, if they said, look, our amendment includes repealing the Independent Payment Advisory Board, the death panel everyone was complaining about in 2010, we can make that cease to exist. Put that in a bill that you send to the president's desk along with the actual Obamacare reforms. I think that would create a lot of political pressure on the president to seriously consider what else they're proposing. Another thing, and I think some of the doctors in independent practice should be excited about this, is that I know when, last time I was on your show, you were not the host, but we talked about, I think it was Dr. Schertz, and we were talking about this increasing trend. It's not new, but Obamacare has accelerated it, that the big hospital systems are rolling up the independent practices, and the independent physician now is a dwindling breed.
Oh, yes.
And hospitals are very skilled at billing Medicare, and they know how to arbitrage the fee schedule, and this is one thing they use to enable themselves to roll up the physician practices. And President Obama himself has proposed in his budget what we call site-neutral payments. You know, the independent doctor in his office can do something, and he bills Medicare maybe half of what the hospital can bill Medicare for the same procedure,
yes.
And the hospital gets to bill more just because it's got a more expensive cost structure. And that doesn't make a lot of sense. And the president has proposed reforming that so the hospitals don't get overpaid versus the independent physicians. And that's something that's lying in the president's budget. And it would save $29 billion in the next 10 years. And the Republicans, this is lying there. They could pick it up and say, okay, Mr. President, we'll give you one thing that you want, and it'll reduce Medicare spending without harming patient care. In fact, one could argue it'll improve patient care because it will help the independent physician maintain his solo practice or his small group practice. And it kind of baffles me why the Republicans in Congress don't pick these things out of the president's budget that would... The president wants them, so give them to him, and that would help him accept some other reforms to Obamacare that they'd be trying to get. So those are a couple of things that hopefully most independent physicians would support, and I think it would show that they're willing to work with the president on things he wants.
Exactly. Let's go on. There's another piece that I wanted to highlight, because we do have physicians in our audience. We also have a lot of non-physicians in the audience. But you do make some comments about the employer mandate and the individual mandate in the context of, pre-existing conditions. Because one of the few popular parts of this is obviously the pre-existing conditions and that people can continue to get insured. But the proponents say, well, hey, you can't eliminate the mandate and keep the pre-existing condition thing, and you kind of blow that up in the paper. So why don't you go over that?
Well, that's the thing. There's a benefit of the King v. Burwell lawsuit that in those 34 to 37 states in which the tax credits will be determined illegal, if that's what the Supreme Court determines, that automatically stops the individual mandate from being enforced. And because the health plan, the policy premium goes up by $3,000 or plus, and so it's unaffordable, and therefore, well, we can't adhere to the individual mandate. So the Obamacare proponents, this causes them to freak out because, well, if you have pre-existing conditions, no exclusion for pre-existing conditions, you get people who wait till they become sick, and then they sign up for health insurance. And in academic economic theory, that is absolutely right.
Yes.
But in private health insurance, there are we don't allow people to buy automobile insurance after they've crashed their car or after their car has been stolen. That would be ridiculous. So these rules in a fully private insurance market make a lot of sense. But because health insurance is politicized and is subject to political incentives, the individual mandate is actually not that important because the politicians have trouble enforcing the individual mandate. So you can avoid the individual mandate by simply checking a box on a form you send to the IRS saying, I found it too difficult to find health insurance. I went to healthcare.gov and I couldn't find a plan that worked for me, so it was an undue burden, so I checked that box and I mail it in, and then they will not impose the mandate on you because it's also politically toxic. And the Congressional Budget Office originally thought that they would raise about, in the 2010 estimate, they'd raise about $6 billion from the mandate penalty tax fine income. And then 2 years later in 2012, they revisited that and said that would only be about $4 billion over the next 10 years. And it's shrinking because they're not able to really, it's politically too difficult for them to enforce the individual mandate. And if you look at a country like, say, Switzerland as an example of a country where there's not a big government health plan, but there's mandatory individual health insurance. In fact, the mandate is not really what drives most of the enrollment. It's the subsidies. You know, in Switzerland, over 80% of households are subsidized into the system, almost 90%, just like Obamacare. Almost 90% of the people in the Obamacare exchanges are subsidized into the system. And the income from penalizing or taxing or fining people is not that big a deal. And if they remove the individual mandate, a few people would stop getting the coverage, but it's really the subsidies that drive people into coverage, not the fear of being penalized or mandated. Because most of us, if you're even in the lower middle income, most of us have still kept our employer-based benefits.
John, we're coming up on a hard break. Do we have you for the next segment?
I'm afraid I got to scooch now. I got another phone call.
Okay. No, thanks. We're on a hard break here. John, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
All right. Good deal. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for spending time with us today. On the first two segments, we were very pleased and very privileged to have John Graham from the National Center for Policy Analysis here with us talking about an article that he just published yesterday, actually a proposal, if you will, sort of addressing what the best response from Congress should be in the event that we may hear within hours that the Supreme Court is going to rule on King versus Burwell, which is, of course, the question of whether or not states who do not have a state exchange, their recipients are allowed to receive Obamacare subsidies. And we've seen a lot about this in recent weeks, and there's a lot of fuel for the fire on both sides of the argument. And John's article does a great job of laying out exactly, a six-point proposal on exactly what the best response would be, and in my opinion, definitely the most cogent proposal that has been put on the table. So I think what we're going to do, we were only able, while we had John for the first two segments, to sort of talk about some of the highlights, and John chose a couple of points that were probably most relevant to the physicians in our audience, although, we're also very, proud and very fond of our non-physician listeners. So we're going to go through some of this in a little bit more detail through the last two segments of the hour. So although you're stuck with me yakking nonstop, I think it's going to be worth you sticking around, because this is something that has to sort of be understood as a complete body of work rather than just the highlights. So I think the first thing we're going to do is sort of go over Mr. Graham's general approach to how a bill could make it through both houses of Congress and get signed by the president. Because obviously, although it would be satisfying to just write a one-page bill or, a two-sentence bill that says everything in the Affordable Care Act is null and void, and for those of us who oppose Obamacare, not because it's Democratic or not because it's liberal, but simply because it's big government, and we both know, every listener here probably knows that big government comes from both parties. It's not just a Democratic thing, and it's not just a liberal thing, but it's a problem no matter who is in charge. But one of the things that you got to understand is that this thing needs to be signed. Right? There's three options. Right. If the Supreme Court rules in favor of the plaintiff, in this case, there are three options. The first option has been called let it burn. Right. This is the option that says, Congress should do nothing. Right. Congress should just let this bill, let this Obamacare fall on its face, rub everybody's noses in it, and use that as a painful example of how bad Obamacare was. And that's a satisfying thing to do, right? I mean, emotionally, that sort of strikes a chord, especially if you're a physician, you have to deal with the problems Obamacare imposes on a daily basis. The problem is it's a bad idea. It may feel good emotionally, but it's a bad idea, first and foremost, because you're going to hurt patients, right? I mean, patients didn't pass this thing. Patients didn't want this thing. And so the idea of saying, look, we're just going to sit here and let it burn and let people suffer is a bad idea. I mean, you're going to hurt people twice, right? I mean, some of these people that are on the exchanges aren't there because of choice. They're there because Obamacare got rid of their existing policy, right? You know, if you like your plan, you can keep it. Sure. You like your doctor, you can keep it. Well, we know those were blatant lies. And there are several million people who are living with the consequences of that blatant lie from the president because they had to give up their policies because they weren't Obamacare compliant. They lacked the essential benefits, as they call them, that Obamacare had to have. So these folks got kicked off their plans. Well, many of them had no other choice but to go to the exchanges. So to take these people who are having to purchase insurance against their will for one reason or another, and then yank the subsidies out from under them so that their the cost of their insurance doubles, or as John Graham said in the last couple seconds, maybe $3,000 a year, clearly is not something that I think we want to do. So the whole let it burn idea doesn't make sense. Well, what's the other extreme? Right, we have another extreme, and that is to simply surrender, right? Obama's got this one already locked and loaded, which is to say, look, if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the plaintiff, right, rules in favor of King, then here's an idea. Here's another two-page or two-sentence bill, right? Instead of a bill that does nothing, here's a two-sentence bill that says we'll just make it legal. Right, we'll just say, look, what we meant to say was that even if you're on healthcare.gov and you're in a state that does not have a state exchange, we'll just make that legal. Well, that is going to be a very difficult one to fight, but if we end up surrendering to that, it is going to set a very, very dangerous precedent on Capitol Hill, because then the practice is going to be, well, if you're the president or you're the executive branch, you can just do whatever the heck you want, then Congress will make it legal. Right? If you want to do whatever you want to do with immigration, that's kind of beyond our scope. But if it's deemed unconstitutional, well, we'll just pass a law. No problem. Right? And so you essentially give the executive branch unlimited power to do whatever they want to, because now you've established a precedent that whatever they want to do, we're going to pass a two-sentence bill and make it legal. That's obviously not acceptable. So what's left? Well, what's left is a bunch of stuff that's in the middle between those two extremes, and you have to come up with the realization that you just can't undo Obamacare, right? Obamacare is like a tumor that's metastasized, right? It's a malignancy that is affecting our healthcare system. And if you are confronted as a doc, as I am sometimes, with a patient that has metastatic disease, you can't just do a giant operation and cut out every focus of metastasis from head to toe. That's not an operation the patient's going to survive, and we know that even if they do, it doesn't cure the problem. It doesn't get rid of the cancer. Once something has spread that far, just trying to cut everything out is not the most intelligent strategy. And it's possible, I didn't get a chance to ask John Graham about this, but you know, if you have a little bit of military experience, and I don't, but I'm just saying maybe as a poorly educated guess, that, you know, if you want to defeat something, that usually the best strategy is not to go running straight at it, screaming at the top of your lungs with your gun over your head. Maybe do something a little bit more nuanced and a little bit more sophisticated. And I think that Mr. Graham has laid that out very nicely in the article. And the approach then becomes the approach to getting something passed, I should say, is going to be based on three tenets that he lays out. The first is that you can't just do a political smackdown with a bill, right? You can't get this one-page undo Obamacare thing passed because he's never going to sign it, right? I mean, it doesn't give him a chance to save face politically. So if you come up with something that's a little more nuanced and you package it as tweaks to the bill, as adjustments to the bill, and say, look, you know, the Supreme Court's ruled that a big piece of this is not the way the law was written. We have to do some fixing. Well, if we're going to have to pop the hood and tear the engine apart, let's make some improvements while we're in there. And then this can be sold as a tweak, as an adjustment, as learning from experience over 3 or 4 years with Obamacare, and we're just trying to learn from our mistakes. And I hope that could be crafted in a way that would let the president kind of save face with his constituency. The other reality is that, and again, it's back to this whole idea that Obamacare has metastasized into places that you just can't cut it out. And one of the places that you just can't cut the thing out is whatever you do, these subsidies, everybody's used to them now. You know, healthcare systems have been built and modified and have grown to need these subsidies. And so if you just turn them off by doing nothing, you're going to wreak a lot of havoc. You're going to wreak a lot of havoc in all 50 states because whether you're on healthcare.gov or a state exchange, you're dependent on the money. The healthcare system's dependent on the money. And John said this very clearly a couple of times in the first two segments, that there's going to be tremendous pressure at the state level to keep that money flowing. So again, you just can't turn it off and rub people's noses in it. That's just not going to work. But it's also a bad idea to simply extend the subsidies temporarily and give Congress time to come up with a more comprehensive fix, because we know what happens then. And I think he referred to it, Mr. Graham referred to that as the wisdom of experience over hope. And it'll turn into another SGR where these things get re-extended and re-extended, and we're going to have, you know, crises every several months to a couple of years. Every time these subsidies come up for renewal, they'll be set to automatically expire, and there's going to be a huge standoff, and all of the crap that we had to put up with every so often for the SGR fix is now just going to happen with extension of the subsidies. So, you know, clearly that's a reality that you have to face if you're going to fix this thing. That right now, assuming that we get a ruling in favor of the plaintiff here, we've got one window of opportunity to do some neat stuff that we're not going to have again unless, you know, something new and unique happens, which is foolish to count on. And then the third tenet, right, we've talked about, you can't just do a political smackdown here. You can't stop the flow of this money in some form or fashion. And the other thing is to, again, this sort of a corollary of the first two, which is that you can't majorly reform Obamacare all in one step. It's not going to happen. So Mr. Graham lays out six parts of the proposal, which are all very, very good. And I hope somebody that's important, somebody who's in power, actually listens to this. But I'm going to start with some of the things that we didn't talk about in the first two segments because, you know, we don't have a lot of time. I want to get to these. One of the biggest ones, and this is important whether you're a physician or a non-physician or, you know, whoever you are who is within the sound of my voice here, has got to understand this, which is that the way the subsidies are set up, the way the math works, is that a disincentive to work is created. If you have a family of four, and you are somewhere between 100% and 200% of poverty level, and your income is roughly $32,000, right? The exact number being $31,720. At that number, $31,720 income per year, there is a step off in the benefit structure, in the subsidy benefit structure. When you earn your next dollar beyond $31,720, you lose income. You lose income because your subsidies drop off sharply to the extent that they far outstrip the increase in money that you get. So when you earn your next dollar, you lose something like $700. So obviously there is a disincentive to earn beyond that $31,720 because you know you're going to lose effective spending power because the subsidies drop. Now, why they would make the math that way, I have no idea, but these step-offs occur all the way up from $31,720 up to $95,000 per year, or something like 400% of poverty level for a family of four, that they have all these crazy step-offs. And it makes it so that there's a disincentive to work. There's a disincentive to work overtime. And so why in heaven's name would you create a structure that has step-offs unless you're trying by design to encourage people not to work, to encourage people to stay dependent on these subsidies, and therefore become a vote that can be bought and sold with government money? And obviously that's been the strategy of liberal big government folks for a long time. We have reached the end of segment three. Stick with us. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
My name is Dr. Jeff Terry from Mobile, Alabama. I love taking care of my patients and not computers. That is why I need your help. On October 1st, the government will mandate that I implement the new ICD-10 coding system, and if not able to do so, then I will be put out of business and my patients will have to find a new physician. Please call and write your congressmen and senators today and tell them no to ICD-10. Tell them physicians need a grace period in order to concentrate on you, the patient, and not the computer.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host for this week, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for joining us today. I alternate weeks with my inimitable co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, and I don't know if he'll be back next week or not. That's the week of July 4th. So I'm not sure if we're going to do a best of or if Hal's going to be here, but whatever it is, it'll be worth listening to. So stick around for the rest of today and be sure and catch us next week. The show here, the Doctor's Lounge, is supported by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. So we're going to talk a little bit about that in the fourth segment here because I wanted to make a few comments, but I wanted to give John all the time that he needed for the first two segments before he had to go. We are supported by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. Thanks to the foundation, I am happy to say that the radio show, The Doctor's Lounge, we are now in our second year. We began our second year. I don't know if it was as of this week or last week. I think our very first show was, June the 12th or June the 14th of 2014. So we are pleased and privileged to be entering our second year. And the mission remains pretty much intact. You know, there's no question that folks need educated. Doctors need to be educated. Patients need to be educated as to what is happening in the healthcare system because things are changing fast and they are not changing for the better. We have in our healthcare system doctors and patients, but we're, in terms of the numbers, in terms of the number of people involved, in terms of the amount of money involved, doctors and patients are becoming an increasingly small part of the overall system. And that's ridiculous because patients are what it's all about, and doctors are the ones who are touching patients and making decisions and making sick people well. And so, those are the two that should be the centerpiece of the system, but that is rapidly going away because of the presence of what I call competitive stakeholders, right? These are the folks, these are health insurers, hospitals, politicians, and I would submit to you that health information technology companies have recently joined the group of competitive stakeholders. These are people who compete with doctors and patients for resources. It is, at many levels, not a cooperative venture. It is a competitive venture, and you need to look no farther than the plethora of regulations, electronic medical record incentives and penalties to understand what is clear, which is that at many levels, not all levels, but at many levels, these entities are not cooperating with doctors and patients. They are competing with doctors and patients. And so part of our mission is to get you to understand how that works and why it works, because true change is more likely to come from patients than it is anywhere else. Because patients hold the key. Your opinion matters more than anyone else's. And so part of what we want to do here is educate you, not indoctrinate you, but to educate you as to what you need to know to make your own informed choices with transparency in cost, transparency transparency in physician training and capabilities, transparency in what the true cost of care is before you get that care, so you can make financial decisions, just like you do when you buy a TV at Best Buy. There's no reason that that healthcare can't follow sort of the same sorts of free market rules. And the bottom line is that something's got to give. Something's got to give very soon. Here's an article that was written by Robert Samuelson that was in the Washington Post yesterday called "Our Runaway Spending on the Elderly." Runaway spending on the elderly. Now, the title sounds almost a little heartless at first, but you have to read what's in the article. And basically, it's a highlight of some of the recent Congressional Budget Office data that came out in the long-term budget outlook for 2015. And there's one particular set of statistics that is interesting, and that is that in 1990, federal spending was about 21% of the economy in 1990. What is that? 25 years ago. Of that 21% of the gross domestic product, one-third of that was spent on Social Security and major health care programs, Medicare and Medicaid. Fast forward to this year, we're still at 21% of GDP, and that kind of surprised me, David. I guess that's because of sequestration or something, but sometimes that number is actually lower than I expected. The problem is that the proportion of that number that is going to the same entitlement programs has increased from one-third to a half, which is a huge amount of money. And if you project forward into the future, another, 15 years, 25 years, to 2040, it's going to go up to two-thirds. And eventually, the entitlement programs are going to squeeze out, between that and interest payments on the debt, is going to pretty much squeeze out everything else. And something's got to give. This author, Robert Samuelson, does a great job of sort of laying out the problem. I don't agree with his solutions. At the end of his essay here, he says, the proper response is to spread the pain. Spread the pain. Some benefits for the elderly should be cut through, and I'm reading straight from the article here. Some benefits for the elderly should be cut through higher eligibility ages, lower payments, and higher Medicare premiums, and some unneeded government programs should be ended. And talking about non-healthcare stuff. Well, that kind of stuff, I don't agree with that. I think that's just going to be rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. I think we're going to need something a lot more, comprehensive than that, because there's just, I don't know that there's enough money in, those kinds of measures that it's really going to make a difference. To make a difference, you need to go back to this book that I talked about 2 weeks ago when I had David Goldhill on, called Catastrophic Care: Why Everything We Think We Know About Healthcare Is Wrong. And one of the things that he talks about in here is the concept of surrogates. Right, the concept that that we as patients, we as consumers of healthcare, are not the people who pay for healthcare. Now think about the folly of that. And we talked a lot last week. I don't want to go into too much detail again. It's in last week's podcast. Please pick that up. Talking about your kids opening a lemonade stand, and if there's a bunch of kids in the neighborhood with lemonade stands, they're all going to be competing for each other for the cost of a price of lemonade, unless the mayor comes through and buys everybody's lemonade at some sort of arbitrary fixed cost. And once that happens, you have a system in place that the lemonade stands are all going to game the system and the price of lemonade is going to go up. Well, the same thing happens in healthcare. I mean, think about it if you were going into Best Buy. Again, I keep going back to buying a TV at Best Buy. If you go into an appliance store, I mean, think about if your rich uncle was going to pick up the tab for your TV, you wouldn't worry about price. I mean, you'd buy the TV, and while you're at it, you'd buy a sound system, and while you're at it, you'd buy a projector TV, and while you're at it, you'd get all the add-ons and bells and whistles, and probably triple the cost of what you'd pay if you were buying the TV with your own money. Well, that is the main driving force that keeps prices down in a free market economy, is the fact that you balance with buyer and seller. The desire of the buyer to purchase something is balanced against the need for the buyer to minimize the cost. And the problem is that in healthcare, those are separated. That we have entrusted, for very bad reasons, we have entrusted the price, the pricing of healthcare to surrogates, and whether that's Medicare or Medicaid or private insurance, you know, the problem is that we assume that somehow that surrogates can price things better than we can, but the bottom line is that that simply isn't true, and part of the reason that it's not true is because there are some widely accepted facts regarding healthcare that simply aren't true and make, you know, health insurance not an insurance but an entitlement program. And you know, Gold Hill talked about this last time, and it's very, very important to understand, which is that if, you know, we think about, you know, healthcare expenses as being sort of a one-time rare thing, when in fact if you look at healthcare expenses over time, nothing can be further from the truth, right? We will all get sick. At some point, if we haven't been sick already, we will all get sick, and we will all incur, at some point in our lives, very, very high health expenses that we need to come up with ways to cash flow ahead of time. And you know, that's, you know, when you have a surrogate system, that's not going to work, and so you end up paying far more in premiums over a lifetime than you are likely to pay in healthcare expenses. In fact, you know, if you really wanted to reform the system, and even John, I think, made a passing reference to Switzerland, but it turns out that Singapore, you know, has a very, very good healthcare system design, and Singapore is often, you know, cited by folks trying to trash our healthcare system because Singapore has a far lower per capita cost for its care, in spite of the fact that it has a good quality care, but they do good quality care at far less cost. Well, how do they do that? You know, we have to look to places like this for some kind of inspiration as to how to move from a system where the person getting the care has no regard for cost because they're not paying for it. Right, it's a prepaid system. Right, it's like a meal plan when you were in college. Right, it's all you can eat because it's prepaid. So there's a huge amount of food and there's a huge amount of waste if you go back to your college days. You know, you need something that says you're going to pay for it. So Singapore's system has five parts. It has a mandatory health savings account where you need to put between 6.5% and 9% of your money into a health savings account. That's called MediSave. So everybody has a health savings account. Required by law, you're putting money away from the very beginning of when you start to earn, when you're healthy and you probably don't have very much health care expense. Those funds, in turn, are spent on two things. One is insurance premiums for the government-sponsored insurance, which is called MediShield. Now, you know, for those of you who would say, aha, this government, you know, they have a government single-payer plan. They have a single-payer plan. Well, yes and no. Their single-payer plan is for catastrophic events only, right? It's the God forbid stuff. It's the cancer. It's the car accident. It's the other kind of trauma. You know, those are the only things that covers. And a lot of people support a system like that. I think David Goldhill, who's the author of this book, supports a system like that, that says, look, everybody needs a safety net. But the safety net doesn't have to cover everything. And that, you know, the safety net we have in this country covers reproductive expenses, birth control, having children, regular checkups, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, that's not a safety net. That's way worse. Anyhow, as usual, I got more here than I got time to talk about. So we are finished for today. You have been listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com. The pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.